Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I am not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I am someone that doesn't drink alcohol, and I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. Right now, I am coming to you live from the Llandaff Studios here in Cardiff, in the Welsh capital in the UK. I'm going to be here until August, and then I'll be returning to Los Angeles. It's been a tough couple of weeks, I can tell you that, and that's why you haven't had so many podcasts. But it's been a tough couple of weeks because I have a two-year-old daughter. She's had jet lag, and she's been up all night. And it's been really, really difficult to get back into the swing of things. And, you know, as much as I like traveling around the world and, you know, visiting different countries, I'm very definitely a creature of habit, structure, scheduling, and I struggle a little bit when I'm out of sync. So I'm hoping to get back into sync as soon as I can. That said, in May I'm heading to Montenegro to work at a poker tournament, so that's going to knock me for six again for a week. But I'm very grateful that I'm here doing all these different things when a decade ago I was a drunk working on the railway, locked in a kind of 9-to-5 lifestyle, not thinking about things. So I'm really grateful about where I am right now. What's currently going on at the moment? Well, we have a taster program running. If you're interested in becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol for a month, then we can help you with that. We've got a taster program running at the moment. Brent from Brisbane, David from Dallas, and Duncan from the UK are all on there at the moment, working with Truth About Alcohol ambassadors Nikki, Laurie, and Craig. They've only been going a couple of days, so if you want to join them, then it is £99. All you need to do is send me an email at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com, or alternatively, go to the website, thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk, and find the taster on there and just press the click buy here button. Strongly suggest you do it. The feedback we've got is fantastic. People love the taster. The last couple who have taken the taster have gone on to do the intensive. It's really important that we get into the arena and start taking the appropriate action. But here's the thing. The taster program and the intensive program, they're very action-orientated experiences, you know. And, you know, Strive and Truth About Alcohol and everything about what we do here is action, action, action. And that is one of the reasons why I stumbled across the work of James and Janice Prochaska, who are going to be our guests today. Because, you know, I was getting all these people coming to Strive and the taster and the intensive. And although the success rate was really high, you know, I was kind of like, perfectionist is the wrong word, but I like to strive to be a better version of myself. I always want to get those statistics to be higher than what they are today. So I started asking a lot of questions. You know, why is it that so many people are on my email list, but they're not in Strive? Why is it that so many people join Strive, but they lurk and they never, ever post anything? Why is it that we have people on Strive that don't take the taster? And why is it that we have people who take the taster, but they then don't take the intensive? And that led me to rereading a fantastic book called Changing for Good. And then I reached out actually to James and Janice Prochaska to ask them to come on the podcast to talk about that book, Changing for Good. And they said, well, hang on a minute. We've got an even better book called Changing to Thrive. And it actually has a chapter on alcoholism in there. So I very quickly downloaded that book on my Kindle, read it on a journey up to Manchester, loved every minute of it, and realized that I had to do a little bit of change. I had to do some change myself around Strive and the Truth About Alcohol in terms of how I was going to serve the people who need me most. So that is what I've done. I've read that book. We're going to be incorporating plenty of changes coming up in the next couple of months. But before then, I will introduce James and Janice Prochaska. James is a director of Cancer Prevention Research Center and professor of clinical and health psychology at the University of Rhode Island. He's the author of over 400 publications, including four books, Changing to Thrive, Changing for Good, Systems of Psychotherapy, and the Trans-Theoretical Approach. He is internationally recognized for his work as a developer of the stage model of behavior change, and he is the principal investigator on over $80 million in research grants for the prevention of cancer and other chronic diseases. He is the founder of Pro Change Behavior Systems. One of the most published authors in the field of social work, Dr. Janice M. Prochaska, is right by his side, and she has led research and development teams for health behavior and organizational change programs as the CEO at Pro Change Behavior Systems from 1997 to 2015. Her collaborations include applying the model to cutting-edge issues like simultaneously reducing multiple risk behaviors and enhancing multiple domains of well-being, healthy weight management in children and adults, preventing bullying, keeping individuals out of trouble with the law, and advancing careers with populations like women scientists. And today, we basically focus on the six stages of change. We go through all six of those stages and try to see how alcohol fits into that. And I really hope that you enjoy it. James and Janice are really open to receiving inquiry from people. So if you've got any questions for them whatsoever, then email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll fire it off to them. If you've got any questions for yours truly, you can do the same thing. So I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of James and Janice Prochaska. Take care, folks. Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. And today my guest is Jim and Janice Prochaska. How are you doing, you lovely people?
Good to be with you.
Yes, thank you for connecting us.
It's a real pleasure. I mean, I first heard about your work reading Changing for Good many, many, many years ago. And you know what it's like with books? You read all these books and then you read it, you make a load of notes, and then you go on to your next book and you forget the old one and the notes. And then the next one and the next one. And I tell you what made me reach out to you was, you know, we have a forum here at The Truth About Alcohol. It's called Strive. And we have a couple of action-orientated experiences. We have a program that we run for a month to help people stop drinking for a month. And then we have one that helps them stop drinking that runs forever, right? And nobody was taking them. And I was thinking, and I was beating myself up, telling myself I wasn't good enough, that I didn't know what I was doing. And then I dug Changing for Good out of the old Kindle. And that's when I got to your website and I realized you had the book Changing for Thrive. So I downloaded Changing to Thrive, and then I realized where I was making my mistake. And we'll start there. Can you tell the people the difference between the mental model of change and the action model of change? Because you'll be able to explain what I was going wrong.
Uh-huh. Okay. Actually, we typically it's called the stages of change model, or the trans-theoretical model. And one of the really important differences is that it recognizes that most of populations with addiction problems and many other kinds of risk behaviors are not prepared to take action. And so when we set up programs for people who are prepared to take action, we're likely to reach very few, or if we'll see, if we do draw some people in pre-contemplation, they're more likely to drop out quite quickly. And there was a group in Canada that had 2% of all casino earnings to set up clinics for what they call pathological gamblers or addicted gamblers. And they advertised and nobody showed. And so they were having to turn back hundreds of thousands of dollars, lose the well-trained counselors. And then they heard me present in Toronto. And what they did was they followed our motto. Traffic light, red light, not ready, yellow light, getting ready, green light, ready, ready or not, give us a call, we can be of help. They put that on the back of buses and they got flooded with calls. And then they were prepared to take and meet people with where they were at in terms of the stages so they could move ahead.
And you can see how the mistake could be made, you know, because I at the moment I have like 500 people who have subscribed to my email list. There's thousands listening to the podcast. So you just automatically assume, oh, well, all these people really want me to help them start drinking alcohol. And I couldn't be further away from
the truth? I mean, can you start by just explaining to people who are unaware of your work what the six stages of change actually are, and a little bit of a brief synopsis for each one?
Yes, first stage is pre-contemplation stage, a stage in which people are not intending to take action in the foreseeable future. It's characterized by demoralization. They've tried many times, by don't know how to change when they're in pre-contemplation. All they know is action. And one of the things that's very important is we were able to show that we could predict over 90% of dropouts from therapy. That was quickly and inappropriately. And they all were basically in pre-contemplation stage. And so it's very important that we know how to engage them and how to help them progress, because otherwise we lose them and we can't be of any help to them. So if they progress, and some characteristics, they see the cons of psychotherapy is greater than the pros. They tend to, in drug treatment, addiction treatment, they tend to perceive that they're there more out of coercion rather than out of choice. And so we can see why they'd be likely to take and drop off. Once they progress into contemplation stage, the pros have gone up, their appreciation of the benefits have gone up, but the cons haven't come down, and they're characterized by profound doubt. Is it worth it? Is it not? Should I keep trying? Should I put it off? Should I go for help? I'll put it off. And so we need to understand the profound ambivalence that they have. And once we help them to progress, and here it involves continuing to increase their appreciation of the benefits of therapy or counseling, but also start to reduce the cons. Once they get into preparation stage, then clearly pros outweigh the cons of changing. The pros of therapy are seen as outweighing the cons, and they're perceiving that they're in therapy or counseling out of choice rather than out of coercion. So they are ready to take action in the next month, and we've really put emphasis on preparation rather than motivation, because we know that people who, in athletics and academics, they know that the better prepared they are, the more likely they are to reach their goal. And it's also a concern, if I'm not motivated, what am I going to do about it? Well, what do we teach people if they're not motivated? You have to hit bottom. You have to have a crisis. I mean, look how demoralizing that is. And so we actually help with new hope, because they're learning something new that they didn't know, and that new opportunity can increase hope. Once they're prepared, we know they're going to be much more likely to continue through action, but we need to make sure they're prepared for the most common reason for relapsing, and that's distress, depression, anxiety, anger, loneliness, boredom. And so we need to have, what's your plan for coping with distress without going back to the bottle, which are other drugs? And so things like who can you talk to, having the support, things like walking or exercise that we know can really bring down stress and distress, things like relaxing or meditation. And so when they're better prepared, likely to get through that demanding time. And many people have been taught that, you can overcome a real habit or addiction in 21 days. Well, just not the case. And so we help them appreciate it's going to take about 6 months of concerted effort. And you need to think of it as like life-saving surgery. If you were going through life-saving surgery, would you give yourself 6 months to take and work harder to get through? Would you let others know you're going to need more support? You're not going to be at your best. And after that 6 months, they move into maintenance. And here now, they're much, much more likely, especially when they went to action, being well prepared, where their profile is the pros of stay and change clearly outweigh the cons, that they're freeing themselves, they're experiencing that it's really by choice rather than by coercion, and they're doing good things to handle distress. We do have a sixth stage. We haven't been able to do as much work with that because typically we would say maintenance would last about 5 years. When do we consider somebody cured from cancer? You know, it's 5 years without symptom remission. And so we look at the criteria for termination is total confidence or self-efficacy, no matter whether I'm angry, bored, lonely, troubled, I have confidence that I can cope with that without going back to the bottle or other drugs, and I have zero temptation. And so then we see almost no chance of relapsing when they have such a positive profile.
What was the number of people that would likely turn up for some sort of therapy or some help that weren't ready to take action? Was it 80% that I read in your book?
That is the most predictable percentage, yes. And so, if we're not prepared, we're really likely to lose them. Let me just give an example. A fellow shows up with a serious drinking problem. He's having marital problems. He's getting in fights at bars. His career is in jeopardy. And, you know, work with him. He helps me to appreciate and understand that he's in pre-contemplation. So how do I respond? Well, first thing I say is, you know, my number one concern is that you will drop out before I have a chance to make a difference in your life. And I don't want either of us to lose that opportunity. So I'm going to be trying to help you in terms of to progress from pre-contemplation to contemplation, because then you're much, much less likely to drop out. And so I will say to him, if you feel me pressuring you to take action when you're not ready, will you let me know? He says, you'll know. How will I know? He says, because I'll get angry as hell. And I say, well, you know, I can work with that. What I can't work with if you're not coming back. So some, you know, just examples of how we can take in and really match what we're communicating to where they are at and helping them so they can start to meet progressing and moving ahead.
It seems to me like communication skills are really important here, especially on behalf of the person who's trying to help. You know, because you said then, like, please let me know if I'm pressuring you to take action. I always feel like I'm pressuring people to take action, but I've never asked that. Never asked that question. And one of the things that I have a problem with as well is we're about to create a free of charge experience, which I'll talk to you about in a minute. But because we're an action orientated movement, because I've been doing it all wrong and I haven't been taking advantage. I didn't read Change into Thrive, so we're set up wrong. They're paid products. So to go to I have a product which fits nice into the maintenance stage, but to convince somebody to do it, I've got to ask them to pay some money. And so it can sometimes come across as like, it's like a marketing spiel. Like the person's thinking, this guy just wants to earn some money. Where it's no. You really need to do this, because if you don't, the likelihood of you relapsing and slipping back to where you were is like a mathematical certainty at the moment, because you need to get into this maintenance phase, you know? So I'm having a bit of a problem there. But I'll tell you what I've done, and you could tell me. Actually, a few questions come up from what you just talked about there, if you don't mind, Jim. When you said the pros need to outweigh the cons in order for you to shift out of pre-contemplation stage, are we just talking a person sitting down on their own and doing that inventory alone? Or are there other tips and ideas that we can give people to shift and deal with the pros and cons? Because a lot of people who come to the truth about alcohol, they think that they want to stop drinking alcohol, but really, they love it. Like, they absolutely love it. So one of the pros is, I love drinking alcohol. You know, so what advice could we give to people for trying to change those scales, if you like?
Well, you can have someone on their own look at the pros, for example, that are in Changing to Thrive. It's the pros of being alcohol-free, not the pros of drinking. So we would emphasize how you might be more productive at work, that you might have better relationships, that you would be healthier, that you wouldn't have hangovers in the morning that set you back. So there's a whole listing there that affects the physical health, the relationship health, the work health.
Yeah. So it's like, and with the exercise, I can do that. Use the book, or you can take different pages from that chapter on alcohol. Mm. And it's like, check off the ones that are most important to you. And, you know, it might be for your kids or your relationship or your job or whatever. And so, yes, we can give them simple exercises that they can do. And we can say, are you confident that you could do this? And what we do recognize, though, is many more people want to change. They really do. But many of those are not prepared. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly moving ahead, we need to be working on what can we replace that alcohol with that can give you joy, that can give you enjoyment, that can help you to feel better and all. And that comes more when we're preparing to take action. But if we've helped them to move just with the pros going up, they're much more likely to stay with us.
Mm. And it seems like that is key, helping someone to be prepared for change, not questioning whether they're prepared to change, which is a very different nuance there. And your chapter on alcohol was amazing. It was really, really good. And it's given me a lot of ideas. So actually working on the pros and cons is something that we do actually much later in our maintenance stage projects, but we're now going to implement that into a new experience. So we realized that we weren't hitting 80% of our market after reading your book. So we're going to create something that works around the pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, which is free of charge. Come on, if you're not ready to take action, come and have a look at this. Come and have a look at Changing to Thrive. Read the book.
Good.
Yeah. And then that question, you know, let me know if I'm pressuring you to take action, I think is really important. I just put a little headline under that.
And just to emphasize, it's not just raising the pros, though that's very important. It's also reflecting on what effect does my drinking have on others, on my friends, on my family, on my work, and also thinking in terms of what kind of person would I be if I wasn't drinking so much. And to help them think through a different kind of self-image.
This reminds me of how I moved from contemplation to pre-contemplation to contemplation, was I realized my marriage was going to fall apart. I just said to myself, I keep drinking, my marriage is going to go. So it's almost like with your list of pros and cons, there are some absolute gems that just have so much power that they override all this other. So my marriage, my kids, my job are like super important pros and cons to think about. Okay, great stuff.
With that example I was talking about with the fellow that was in pre-contemplation, I said, well, one of the things I know that could help you to stay so we can make a difference in your life is for you to appreciate what are the benefits that you might get from staying with the therapy. And I, you know, one was, you think it could help you with your drinking? I said, well, I hope so, but not sure. You think it could help you with your marriage? Well, my wife sent me here. You think it could help you with your work? Yeah, I really need help with that. You think it could help you to make more money? He says, well, you'll make more money. I said, well, that's true, and I appreciate that. But it's not. As far as I know, there's only one thing that you could do with your time that could have more benefits than psychotherapy or counseling. He said, what is that? I said, well, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want you to leave for that. I was joking, but I'll tell you later.
I like it. I especially like that because if he's gambling, money's going to be a bit of a part. I'm a former gambling addict myself. You know what I mean? I like that. It's very smart. Very smart. You talked about when you get to the action stage, that it could take 6 months of concerted effort. I think we use the term "do the work" here at the True Power Call. What describe what that means to you? What is concerted effort? Because 6 months seems like a long time.
Well, numbers of things. One is that, I mean, you come in prepared for when there's times of distress, and those are the time most of us are at our psychological and emotional weakness. And so, you know, distress is going to happen. You know, that's not a choice. The choice is being prepared so that you can do the work. When I'm distressed, yes, I'm tempted to go back to the bottle, but I have already been preparing in terms of, let's say, in terms of going walking for my distress. And others could be saying relaxing or meditating and other positive kind of things. Being in a support group that I can call on and call on the phone if I'm feeling really tempted. So those are the kinds of work and effort to, you know, to keep moving ahead.
And another process of change would be to change your environment some so that you're not as tempted to go back to drinking by avoiding certain places, avoiding certain people, avoiding certain stimuli. If you always took a drink after work or on Fridays, and changing your lifestyle so that you're not pulled back into that kind of situation.
It's almost like you know, when we talk about sitting down and meditating and trying to sit with the feelings of the triggers and meditating your way through that. But what really we want to be pushing to people is for them to become a meditator. So it's just something that they do. Like, it's a daily practice, which equals the concerted effort. So part of the concerted effort is, I'm going to become a meditator. I'm going to meditate each day. And I think, looking at your calendar of your day and have a good look of what do I do? What do I do every day now as an addict? You know, and how am I going to change that? What you're talking about there is being prepared. It's almost like in the preparation section, we can help people to be prepared by creating almost like relapse kits and stuff like that.
Yes, but one of the things that we encourage is, like if they do a list, you know, this week, walking for my drinking, next week, walking for my stress, the following week, walking for my self-esteem, walking for my kids, walking for my job. And what we want is, because what we tend to do as specialists is focus just on one problem, you know, walking for my drinking, walking for my drinking, walking. And with this kind of approach, it's like they're affirming so much of their body, their self, their relationships, and they're motivating themselves with saying, wow, this isn't just about my drink. This is about me becoming much more of a whole person, healthy person.
Yeah, I remember talking to a friend of mine who was having a problem with alcohol. And at the same time, she was learning all about Buddhism. And I remember saying, when she reached out to some advice, stop focusing on the alcohol and focus on the Buddhism. Because I think what you're saying there is, if we look at our life holistically and start to really pay attention to health and wellness and our financial and our relationships and communication, if we start to put those things right, then we're going to be happier. And if we're happier, we're less likely to want to self-medicate. Is that what you're saying?
And in action, you're substituting one healthy behavior for the unhealthy behavior, like what you're saying about meditation or Buddhism.
Yeah, no, I really like that.
And I think also helping people to understand, you know, like the dynamics about the pros need to go up from pre-contemplation to contemplation, the cons need to come down from contemplation. I mean, there's work that has shown that exact pattern has worked, holds for over 48 different behaviors. So one of the things that we like to do is, hey, we're going to change your behavior, change IQ, so that not only can you apply it to your drinking, but you can apply it to other areas of your life that can enhance your life.
Speak a little bit more about behavior change IQ, Jim.
Well, that comes from the fact that from pre-contemplation to action, the pros have to go up what's called 1.00 standard deviation. That's like raising your IQ by 15 points.
Wow.
And that's a big increase. But given that most people don't know how to change in terms of, most don't know about the stages, they don't know if they're in a, what stage, what to do to progress to the next one. And you know, the idea of having a behavior change IQ, just like we also talk about emotional IQ, can really increase people's confidence and say, wow, look at what all I'm getting from this program, not just from my alcohol, but then has so many different parts of my life.
So we have a year-long experience called the intensive, and the people that go through it love it. And they say that what they love about it is it doesn't focus on alcohol. It deals with all aspects of life. So it's very holistic.
Right.
And the testimonials are great. We also have a program called The Taster, which is a pared down version of that. So it's an introduction to our philosophy, incorporates a lot of the work that you guys do and a lot of other game changers out there. And that's 27 days. So it's for the people who are not ready to commit for life yet, but let's give it a go and see how you feel after 27 days. And the feedback on that is excellent. However, trying to get people to leap from the taster, which I define as being, we're now taking action, to the intensive, which is action incorporating and moving into maintenance, I'm finding it really, really difficult. Really difficult. So what are some of the reasons, do you think, that prevents people from, it's almost like they've taken action, so they think they've nailed it. Like, I've nailed it. I know how not to drink now. I understand what Lee's on about. So I don't need any of this maintenance nonsense. I've got it. What? How do we get people to change their minds other than them coming to us saying, oh my God, I've just lost my wife, lost my kids. You were right. I do need to do this now. Like, how? What can we do differently?
Well, I think 27 days is a good period of time. And I think you are doing some of the things that would help them to transition. And that is that if you're really helping them to look more holistically at their health and their well-being, it could be helpful if you were having some kind of, you know, assessments like we do in our program. That can give people, you know, feedback of how they're progressing in multiple areas, and so they can see more of the benefits that they're getting. And now they're not necessarily there on each of the important behaviors and areas of well-being, but the progress is one that can help people to stay with it. You will have folks, and one of the things you're up against is the media still, like at New Year's, will say, you know, 21 days to get a new habit, a healthy habit, and remove the old one. Well, that is just a real mistake. So people may, you know, feel like, let's say, unduly confident because they've made it through that, that key period, and not recognizing that, they need more. The other one is they go and they run with it, but you can leave the door open. You know, if you're lapsing, you know, give us a call and come on back. If you areas of life you're wanting to enhance more that you're not really finding a way to do that, you know, give us a call and come back, and we keep the door open for you.
And with the relapse, if there is one, what can we learn from it so that we can move forward again?
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm always trying to impress, that if you come knocking on the Truth About Alcohol door or the Prochaska's door and you say, hey, I've lost control of my alcohol intake and I want to change that, and we have to accept that actually drinking and relapsing may actually be part of the process, because the evidence shows that a lot of people are going to go there. So rather than us set this perfect kind of expectation that, oh, we're never going to drink and then end up, was it the triple D's that you talk about in the book, or the three or four D's, you know, of desperation and demoralization. is rather than say, okay, hang on a minute, you know, we are going to drink here, but when we do, it's really important that we try as best as we can to drink really mindfully, and to really experiment and ask ourselves, is it actually providing me with the value that I've believed for 20, 30 years that it does? And I think that helps people out a lot more. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. It's like being more mindful through relapse.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And one of the things you can also be mindful of is, like, we put a lot of emphasis on relapse prevention and the causes of it, but we also look at what's the consequences of it. Like, when you relapse, what stage do you relapse back to? And, the good news is we find a majority of people do not relapse all the way back to pre-contemplation. And we say, hey, well, that's great. Because, you know, in terms of getting demoralized, our message is there's only one serious mistake that you can make, and that's giving up on your ability to change your life. We're not going to give up on that. We're going to try to help you to not give up on that.
How important is it for somebody going through this process to understand with a great deal of clarity the six stages of change? Because when I was reading Changing for Thrive, I was thinking to myself, I need to know this. Like, I need to know where my people are so I can help them. But I don't think I put as much emphasis on they need to know this and I need to be teaching them this so yes. They understand the consequences and the pros and cons of shifting through stages. How important is that?
I think it's very helpful for a person to realize that there are six stages and to think through where they are at right now, so that they would know what they could do to move to the next stage, and that you would know how you could help them to move to the next stage. So I know therapists who have laid out the six stages and then asked the patient or the client, where do they think they're at? And say, oh, wow, okay, you're in pre-contemplation. There's just five more stages to go. And these are some things that you could do to move to the next stage, and these are some things that I could do to help you to do that. And then that kind of clarity really can help the person see that there is a way out of where they're at.
Yeah. And also, just to promote our book, Changing to Thrive, you know, was written for the public, though professionals certainly use it as well. And it does have exercises in it that people can do. It does help them to understand that what they're learning about alcohol, for example, can help them in other areas of their life. But one thing that we also build is they're progressing. As they're changing some behaviors, we see that they can start to increase their physical well-being, increase their emotional well-being, not just reducing anxiety, depression, stress, but also increasing happiness and joy. And what we also see is, and this is working with a population of 4,000 people, the majority came in, were suffering or struggling. In our treatment group, the majority, in a matter of 6 month period, the majority were now thriving. And so, it's like we're not just removing something, but we're really building towards a fuller life, a happier life, a life where we're thriving.
The other thing you've done quite brilliantly is, a lot of people come to me and the thought of never drinking alcohol ever again in their life is so terrifying that they don't want to go into the action stage of things, right? What you've done by introducing the six stages of change is, it's like the old adage, if you want to eat an elephant, you've got to do it one spoonful at a time, right? If like you've done in your book, if you can clearly lay out the changes and say, this is what you need to do to get to the next stage, then that person who is probably overwhelmed with fear and shame and guilt and worried that they're going to fail, now they only have to focus on doing these things to get to the next stage, then these things to get to the next stage. And I think that's quite brilliant. Was you thinking about that when you did it, or did you just deal with the research that was in front of you?
Well, we actually were taught by the stages of change and what to do at each stage by 1,000 ordinary people that we followed for 2 years. And they were assessing what they were doing at each stage and really learn from them. And then we were able to, you know, our mission was to bring it to as many people as possible. And, you know, it's, you know, I grew up believing in the wisdom of ordinary people. My dad worked in the factory. My mother was a waitress. And ordinary people are what taught us about the stages and the processes to progress from one stage to the next.
No, I one thing you talked about earlier on, which really spoke to me, when I first created my intensive program, we had feedback forms that we used on a weekly basis. Now, don't get me wrong, it was like pulling teeth trying to get people to fill them in. But when they did fill them in, I, as the person helping them, could see how they were progressing. But more importantly, they could see how they were progressing. And there was that interaction about whether or not they felt that I was providing the right amount of empathy. And somewhere along the line, I stopped doing it. And listening to what you said, I mean, I'll ask you the question, how important is it for an individual to understand where they are and how they're progressing and what their relationship is like with their mentor?
Well, I think we know across all kinds of areas of health, including like with medications and stuff that have been proved to be, you know, life-saving, but counseling therapy and all, that the more people see progress, the more likely they are to stay with it.
Mm.
And if they're feeling like, gee, you know, I'm stuck, I'm not getting you know, enough out of this, and we do assessments and say, wow, look at the progress we've made here. It's also a good thing in terms of when we do it. I mean, now our programs are multiple behaviors and doing it simultaneously. So people can see progress in a variety of different areas. And they tend to work together to help people really move towards whole health for their whole life.
I stopped drinking in 2008. And 3 years later, my wife divorced me. And I don't remember this consciously at the time, but in hindsight, assessing why I drank, because I was in Las Vegas and I just remember I was at drinking Shirley Temples, like some non-alcoholic garbage. And then the waitress come around and I said, I'll have a shot of Sambuca. And the people I was with weren't really close friends, so they didn't understand what was going on. You know, like I was drinking for the first time in 3 years. And I look back in it and I think the reason that I drank is I was dealing with something that I wasn't prepared for, that I was going to be alone for the rest of my life, that I was going to be ugly, that nobody would want to be with me, that like I'd lost everything. And I'd never prepared for that. And I always wonder when I was reading your book, you know, what happened to me? Was it because I was in maintenance and I was... It happened to me in 3 years, you know, like, because I actually fell back to contemplation. I actually started thinking, well, could I moderate, et cetera, et cetera. It lasted about a month. Is that typical of what could happen in a maintenance phase?
Well, I expect you to help people to differentiate between a lapse and a relapse and a slip versus a fall and, you know, preparing for the lapse being a learning opportunity rather than a failure opportunity. You know, our model is not just like straight ahead. You know, we use like a spiral staircase where, you know, you're going to flip back, but then you can start to move ahead. And again, the only serious mistake you can do is to give up on yourself. And the good news is, you know, without our, I think because of knowing about the behavior change process because of increase in their IQ, they can recognize a lapse, they can recognize where they're at and how they can start to again pick up and start to progress again.
So it's just a case of this stuff is going to, you never know what's going to happen in your life, what could come along and trip you up.
I mean, I, obviously that was very stressful with the divorce and it's hard to use all of your resources to cope with that. But as Jim was saying, hopefully that would not last for months and months and months. And in your case, it lasted a month and you were able to get back on target.
It's almost like that voice that says, look, I know what I need to do. I know I need to go for a walk. I know I need to meditate. I know I need to get my list out. I know I need to ring my friend, but I'm not going to do it. I'm going to drink. Like that really super powerful voice that will nail you sometimes. I got to be honest, it was a shock to me that it turned up after 3 years. I was the person on the rooftop going, I'm never ever going to drink ever again, which I'm there now singing from the rooftop, you know. But and I think your reason I feel more confident now is because that was such a traumatic moment for me that I think to myself, you know, what else that could happen to me that would be as traumatic, kind of thing. But yeah, very interesting. No, actually, Jim, I don't go into the nuance of relapse and lapse. And all I generally do is just tell people to expect it's going to happen, create a list of tools to kind of for them to work with their mentors on how to reduce the likelihood that it will happen, like changing your environment, changing your behaviors, you know, getting ahead of the game type of thing. And more importantly, is just really all being there for somebody when it's happened, because it's that such overwhelming desire to run and feeling of failure. I'm going to be talking about the fear of failure on a different podcast today. You know, for me, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but you know, the podcast I'm going to do after I finish speaking to you both is, for me, the only failure is when we pack it in and we decide not to do that concerted work. That's for me the only failure. Drinking's not a failure. Taking drugs is not a failure. Gambling's not a failure. It's you're fighting against a really, really tough opponent in this ring, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we also help people to understand, and we talk about it in Changing the Thrive, is, you know, we're changing our brain. You know, the pathways to drinking, mm-hmm. the pathways to smoking, those are hardwired in. Those don't go away. And we know that relearning a habit can happen so quickly. And so, you know, part of it is we need to keep strengthening that pathway to healthy ways of coping with distress, for example, and recognizing, hey, the times, you know, we don't have a choice about being distressed. Some of those things will come at us, and the better prepared we are, but we may slip, we may lapse, because that brain is still wired for it. And when we get depressed or distressed, we tend to be, you know, more tempted. But again, it doesn't have to take over us. But we have to, it's like learning, okay, my pathway to healthy alternatives needs to be strengthened. That's what my challenge is.
And I know you've got to go in a minute, Janice. So thank you for joining. I really appreciate your time. So I'm gonna ask you both a question now. So if you have to sneak out mid answer, it's perfectly fine. What are the biggest challenges that you're finding, or have you found throughout the years, when it comes to helping people along the spectrum of the six stages of change? What are the ones that you go to bed at night and you're thinking, or you'll be thinking, how can I get people through this, from this stage to this one? You know, what are the ones that's big challenges for you?
Well, I would think that most helpers would say moving someone from pre-contemplation to contemplation, because they're the patients or clients that can discourage you if you can't get them to, you know, be prepared and take some action. And you need to stop yourself as a clinician and say, whoa, let me really listen to where this person is at, and let me help him understand or her understand where she and he is at, and how can I get them to move a little bit to contemplation.
I would say for us, speak for myself, the biggest challenge is, how do we reach more people? I'm a missionary. My mission in life is to enhance the health and well-being of as many people as possible. And it does trouble me that still, even the, you know, health professionals, yeah, you know, are just prescribing action after action after action. You know, look at physicians. They prescribe a medication that you got to take every day for the rest of your life. Do they ask somebody, are you prepared to take this medication every day for the rest of your life? No. Well, look at the rates of discontinuing with medication. And so really, the frustration is that the action model, we're such an action-oriented country, that it just still continues to dominate at the expense of many people who, and the therapists tend to blame it on the person, right?
Mm.
Well, that you weren't motivated enough, or that person was defensive or resistant, or, hey, let's recognize, if we're prescribing action to somebody who's not prepared for it, we're going to cause problems, and we should own responsibility for that.
Yeah, and I know for me, I'm the type of person who just wants to fix everybody, which is a real weakness of mine. So, of course, when I stopped drinking alcohol, and I said to myself, right, I understand it. Like, for me, it was like, I realized there was no value for me in drinking it at all. And I was, and I'd been hoodwinked by marketing, advertising. So then I'm like, right, I gotta go and fix everybody. And of course, of course, like 10 years later, here I am, you know, still struggling to get the message out, because I have such a big, vast piece missing, which is 80% of people listening here. I haven't been helping. I have been helping. Don't get me wrong. They'll listen to this and it will help them. But then saying, right, come and jump and start doing this and stumble, you know, it's not what they've been looking for. So I think you're doing the right thing, jumping on podcasts, your book, of course, Changing for Thrive. I would get on more and more podcasts. I know for a fact as well, Jim, that whenever I talk to people, or whenever I've talked about this podcast, for example, everyone's been like, oh, wow, you're speaking to Jim and Janice Prochaska. You know, so they know you, they know you of your work, but I can definitely see the frustration of reach, you know.
Well, and I appreciate that in terms of that feedback, and we do value that. We value that very much. I would say my frustration is much more with the professionals that, the modeling gets misused. People will say, they will take and use the model to assess who's in preparation stage, and those are the only ones that they'll have in a program.
Right.
Of course, you're going to raise your success rates, but you're going to lower your impact because you're excluding 80% of the people.
Mm. So, just going back to what Janice said, I know she's gone now, but the pre-contemplation stage. When I first read that, I was thinking to myself, well, that's my mum and dad. So my mum and dad drink a lot, and I've drunk a lot for many, many, many years, but they're not really... they don't really understand that they are drinking a lot. Like they think that the amount that they're drinking is normal, because when they look around them, everybody else is. So I put them in a pre-contemplation stage. But I guess what you're also saying as well is you'll end up, people will come to you for I don't know, they could be suffering from depression or whatever, and then you can uncover that there's this alcohol issue. And they're not even aware about it. So they're with you and they've come for help for something else. And now you're like, oh, we need to shift them from pre-contemplation to contemplation, because they don't even realize there's an issue. So to me, it's like, I need to think a bit broader about who fits into that pre-contemplation stage.
Yeah, and one of the things we know, like we have really good data on, let's take in terms of with smoking, 80% of smokers want to quit, but 80% are not prepared to quit. So we've got this huge disconnect of so much of an action model being thrown at them, which makes them defensive, right? I mean, that's like what I was trying to prevent with that client I was talking about. Let me know if one person needs to take action. And so there is latent motivation there, wanting to. But, what you're saying, one of the things I encourage people to do is, hey, measure how much you drink. In Change and Thrive, we talk about an example of a psychiatrist who was, his daughter was really concerned, and he was slurring and having trouble with balance and stuff. And he said, well, I have only one drink. Well, she measured it, and it turns out it was the equivalent of 5 drinks.
Yeah, I I watched a documentary in the BBC on the BBC recently. Quite a famous TV personality in the BBC called Adrian Childs, and he was analysing how much he drank. So he was going by the UK guideline, recommended guidelines. I used to be a believer that all that was nonsense. I used to say to myself, "Well, what's the point of the guidelines? If someone would have thrust them in front of my face when I was drinking, I wouldn't have meant anything to me." But it was clear when Adrian was looking at them on a day-to-day basis, it was really bothering him that he could see that he was drinking too much. And all of a sudden, I felt to myself, wow, there's a great power in raising awareness here in these stages to help people reach their own conclusion that they, because that's important, isn't it? We can't turn around and say to someone, oh, you are in this stage. It's really much better for them to understand that and raise their own personal awareness of where they are, right?
Yes. Let me just give a personal example. In our Cancer Prevention Research Center, we were going to be working on healthy eating. And so one of the colleagues developed an assessment of healthy eating, and she had 50 of us completed, and then gave confidential feedback to where did we rank in those 50 people. Well, here I am, the director of the center, and I turn out, I'm number 50. Oh, my God. Well, did that break me out of pre-contemplation?
But, I mean, that raises a really interesting point, is like understanding what triggers individuals. So that to me sounds like a little bit of a status. Oh, I'm direct. I need to sort myself out because I'm the director here. So it's like, oh, so this person, status is important. When with the gambler you were talking about earlier on, oh, for this person, money is there. It's almost like finding the mode of communication that can help bond the therapist or the mentor or whatever with the person who's struggling. And that in itself is a lot of experience, I imagine, Jim, and a lot of hard work, right?
Well, and a lot of learning from people, you know, that first 1,000 that we've had, you know, studied with tens of thousands of people, and we've always learned from each one, you know, new things that we could be then sharing with other people.
Okay, nobody joined us today, which is a shame, but I do have one question from Serena. Serena is one of our Truth About Alcohol ambassadors, so she helps people stop drinking alcohol. And Serena said, "Hi, Lee. I have a PhD student who is exploring the stages of change model in relation to maintenance of long-term sobriety. His data have shown that the role of personal meaning is key to maintenance rather than time going through certain discrete stages. I wondered if you could ask what their thoughts are on that and whether they incorporate personal meaning into their model."
That's a terrific question. I have to say, for both Janice and myself, at this stage of our life, really meaningful interactions with people, meaningful activities, you know, it just makes such a difference. And it's part of the thing about expanding the meaning of you know, being sober, of not going back to drinking. What all does that mean to me? But also finding things that are meaningful. You know, just to share with you, there was a study done on the 300 most elite colleges and universities in the U.S., and they found that with almost no exception, more than 50% of the graduates from those elite schools said they did not have a meaningful career or job. And, you know, that's just really sad. And so, you know, part of what we would say is, well, what kind of meaningful avocation could you do if your job isn't so meaningful? But we belong to a group that was we joined it when it was called a contemplation group. Average age is over 80, and each week, you know, we gather together. Somebody takes the lead, and we just have wonderful, meaningful, you know, kinds of interactions. So yeah, I think that is really, really important. And it's, you know, ask her to have that PhD student share what he's finding with me. I'd love to see that.
Okay. Let me make a note of that. I mean, what you were talking about earlier on was this, wasn't it? When we were talking about the maintenance state, moving from the action to the maintenance stage, you were saying that it's really important to expand a person's almost like vision or thought process away from the particular ailment, in this issue, alcohol, to greater meaning in life. You were talking about that. So, you know, when we go for a walk today, we'll think about how we can improve our relationship with our kids, with our wife, in our job, with my personal health and well-being, in my spiritual life, in my religious life. And then I guess when you're doing that, you are tossing up the question of meaning and purpose, which is something that we cover in depth on our intensive course as well, which I think is like really important, because I always say to people, dig yourself in the trenches for the long haul, because if it's going to take 6 months to get from preparation to action, and then it's going to take another 5 years to go through maintenance, dig yourself into the trenches, right? Now, if that's the case, people don't want to talk about alcohol for the next 5 years. So you have to be working on, okay, now you're someone who doesn't drink alcohol. How do you fit now in society? What are we going to do about our friendship groups, because they all drink? What are we going to do about our relationship with our wife, because she still drinks? What are we going to do career-wise, because we hate it? What are we going to do hobby-wise, because we don't have any, because all we used to do was go to the pub and watch a football? That, my friends, takes 5 years plus. Much, 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 much longer, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, that is... true, but what we found when we were working with the 4,000 people in our treatment condition, with changing a couple of behaviors, we did not treat their multiple domains of well-being, and yet we found that their physical well-being improved, you know, really very significantly. Their emotional well-being improved very significantly. Their work well-being improved very significantly. And as I talked about, the majority that were suffering or struggling, majority moved to thriving. So, but you know, it's like measuring those things and giving people feedback about that. Look at all that you're affirming about life, about your life, about others.
No, I think one thing that I've taken away from this conversation for myself, as someone who's a guide to other people, is the importance of providing a measurement and feedback mechanism within the work that we do. I know that Dr. David Burns, Feeling Good Author, and he's been a guest on the show, absolutely believes that it's super important. You just mentioned it as well. And I got to learn from you guys every inch of knowledge that I can get. Jim, thank you very much. I will make sure that everybody who listens to this buys a copy of Changing to Thrive. It is one of the best books you will ever read if you want to recover from alcohol addiction, because you're listening to this, but much more than that. You know, the stages of change helps me in my relationship with my son. It helps me in my relationship with my wife. It helps me figure out my cognitive dissonance around the things that I do to pay the bills. It's a fantastic, fantastic book. I'll also create a link there so you can go to Jim's website and you can reach out to Jim. I'm sure he won't mind you sending him an email. They were very quick to reply to me when I wrote to them. And you can also work with them as well, because they know this thing far better than I do. Okay. Jim, you got anything else to say before I let you go?
Listen, I really do appreciate, and Janice does as well, the opportunity to reach more people with interacting with you and sharing, you know, our experience and our knowledge with others.
Brilliant. Okay, I'm going to keep in touch. You have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us on the Truth About Alcohol podcast.
Okay, thank you.
If the Truth About Alcohol philosophy jives with you and you want to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then there are several options available to you, okay? According to the research carried out by Janice and James Prochaska, there are 6 stages of change when it comes to defeating an addiction. And let me assure you, that is your problem. It is an addiction, right? Now, these six stages of change are as follows. One, pre-contemplation. Two, contemplation. Three, preparation. Four, action. Five, maintenance. And six, termination. And translated into truth about alcohol philosophy, these categories become this, right? Number one, the death effect. Number two, visualization. Number three, incubation. Number four, ready, steady, go. Number five, transformation. And number six, service. And that just makes a nice little acronym, STRIVE. Ha! That's why I did that, right? So these six stages of the truth about alcohol are not fixed in stone, right? They're fluid. And you'll move between these stages depending on a variety of different factors. But understanding where you are on this spectrum is really critical, okay? Now, number one, the first category you're going to be in, which the Prochaska's called pre-contemplation, and I'm calling the death effect, that's when you really are struck by the zombification of societal conditioning. You have no idea that alcohol is a problem, that alcoholism exists. You just think that alcohol is fucking brilliant and that is the end of, right? And that will not be affecting you right now because you're here listening to this. But that is that first level, that first category, the death effect. At the second level, contemplation, as the Prochaska's call it, or for me, visualization, this is where you start to think and question the role that alcohol has in your life, right? And as you're thinking about this and you're pondering and you're kind of visualizing kind of like, you know, how alcohol is having a negative effect in your life and what it could possibly be like if it's not in your life anymore, you may have joined the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and listened to this. You may have headed over to the truthaboutalcohol.co.uk and joined our email list. You might be reading our blog post. You might have picked up a few books and started reading on those. At the third stage is called preparation, right? Or what we call incubation. And this is where you might go a little bit further. And you're now starting not only to kind of listen to podcasts and read some books, but you're actually preparing to change, right? The idea that you could potentially be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is starting to incubate. And you could, at this stage, have joined a community forum like Strive. Or you might have joined NIST Naked Minds forum or Hip Sobriety's Facebook group or something. But you're starting to prepare for change. The fourth category is action, or what we call ready, steady, go. And this is where you really are now starting to take some real solid action. And if you're ready to take action, then you should take the Truth About Alcohol Taster. And the Truth About Alcohol Taster is a 27-day program. You can join the program whenever you like. You just go to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can find the links there to join up. Or you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll sort you out. You join basically a group and you can just work on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol for 27 days to give it a little bit of a feel. We'll introduce you to the Truth About Alcohol philosophy, our three modules of truth, awareness, and freedom. We'll learn to help you see the truth about alcohol, why you drink, why it's so difficult to stop, raise awareness of that truth internally so you can start to change some of those neurological pathways, those thought process and belief systems around alcohol. And then freedom, how do you assert yourself back into a society of people that don't drink alcohol? You do the homework on Strive, you get an assignment every day from myself, and one of the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors will lead you along the way. So that's kind of the action stage. The fifth stage is called maintenance, or what we call transformation. This is where the work really takes off, right? Now, it's really important to understand that moving between the incubation phase and the ready, steady, go phase, you know, so whilst you're kind of like preparing to take action, that could take anywhere up to 6 months. And once you've started to take action, the actual maintenance phase, which is what we call transformation, the stage where you are really working on becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol permanently, that phase can take up to 5 years, right? It can take that long. It certainly takes six months plus for you to really nail it or give yourself a good shot at this. And for that reason, we've created the intensive. The Truth About Alcohol Intensive, it's a year, an annual subscription where we get really deep into the truth about alcohol, raising awareness of that truth and working out how to be free of it. And we're up to like 70 plus coaching videos. You work with all the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors and myself. It's a great, great process, okay?
One of the big mistakes people make is they'll take the taster, so they start to take action, and then once they finish the taster, they don't continue into the maintenance phase, and that can lead them fall back into some of those earlier categories. So it's really important to do the intensive and get through that transformation phase. And then finally, six, termination, as the Prochaskas call it, or I like to call it service. This is where it doesn't matter what happens now, you're never going to drink alcohol. It doesn't matter, you're never triggered, nothing ever happens, you're just fucking done with it, right? And that's where I am right now. And this is where we at the Truth About Alcohol can offer you some roles to, you know, give back to the community, give back to the world, and help me create this movement of a million people that don't drink alcohol. And that is to extend yourself into the roles of either a Strive ambassador, where you lead in the Strive movement and really are a rock helping new people come to Strive, or you can become a Truth About Alcohol ambassador, where we pay you to take control of the taster groups and the intensive groups and really work with people who are ready to take the action phase. So if you are ready right now, okay, to start to think about moving up into the next stage, so, you know, you're in contemplation phase now and you're thinking about going to preparation, join Strive, right? It's £5 a month. It'll be the best £5 you've ever spent. If you're ready to take action, if you're ready to do something about this, then join the taster. Okay, that's £99, right? Join the taster. And then if you are just ready to just fucking be someone that doesn't drink alcohol and that is like something you want to do permanently, then join the intensive. That is £1,000. We've got payment plans available. Do not let money be the reason why you do not take this, because we can always sort something out or find you some help, all right? So head over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk to join those experiences, or give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Remember this, folks, okay? You drink alone, but you do not have to stop drinking alone. That's why we're here for you. So reach out and help. Take care of yourself.